KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thanks for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Professor John Taranian of Chapman University School of Law, author of the forthcoming book Infringement Nation, Copyright 2.0 and You. We have focused on the show several times on copyright law issues most recently related to things like the Commons with Professor Mike Madison at Pitt, but really going back to the inception of the show with one of my earliest guests, Professor Larry Lessig, who's now at Harvard. We have explored the parameters of copyright law both from a positive perspective in terms of what it does right, but also from the perspective of what it does wrong. And in John's book, the title suggests where we're headed. John analyzes the various ways that one can infringe copyrights in ways that in many cases are unexpected, and certainly in other situations are surprising. And the range of discussion that we're going to have today is reflected in the table of contents for John's book, where he talks about different ways that individuals can infringe copyrights. The individual as an infringer, as a transformer, as a consumer, as a creator, and as a reformer. So throughout the book, John is analyzing these different perspectives and impacts of copyright law. And at the end, he has some suggestions on how copyright law should change, with some surprising insights on certain issues like fair use that we generally think of as good things. And John explores a less theorized dark side to a fair use in propertizing creations that ultimately maybe we shouldn't be treating as property per se. So I'm very excited to have John on the show. John is a repeat guest. He was on the show about a year ago discussing a previous book, Whitewashed, but today we're focusing on copyright. By way of, again, brief background, John is a professor at Chapman University School of Law, where he's the director of the Entertainment Law Center. He's also the founding partner of One LLP, an entertainment intellectual property firm in Southern California. John's handled quite a few high-profile copyright infringement cases, covering a number of entertainment industry luminaries. He was previously a professor of law at the University of Utah and a visiting professor at Loyola Law School, and is a graduate of Harvard University and Yale Law School. So John is joining us by Skype from his home in California. John, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
It's a real pleasure, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start off, John. And again, for listeners, I'm fighting a little bit of a cold, as you might hear. And so I promise you that I'm going to do my best to not cough, as it doesn't make for the best radio. John, as far as I know, is healthy. And so so the main focus of the show, John, as guest, should go just fine. John, let's start off with a standard question that I ask a number of most of my guests on the show, particularly authors. What is the genesis of this project, or why did you choose to write this book now?
You know, the genesis of the project actually emerged from a small article I did. In fact, it was probably the shortest article I've ever written, and not coincidentally, probably the most widely read article I've ever written. It was by the same title, Infringement Nation. It came out a couple of years ago. And basically, the crux of the article was a symposium issue of the Utah Law Review that I was putting together that had contributions from a lot of wonderful scholars in copyright, including Pam Samuelson and David Nimmer and others. And the issue was looking at beginning to think about copyright reform. It had been over three decades since the passage of the last comprehensive reform of the Copyright Act, of course, the Copyright Act of 1976, which still governs. And of course that act was written and drafted in the 60s and 70s, largely before the digital revolution, indeed before the widespread development of the internet and the World Wide Web. And so the idea was starting to look at issues of reform in copyright law. And in my particular sort of contribution to that symposium, I decided to do a hypothetical. I came up with the idea of looking at what would happen if we charted the course of an ordinary individual's life just for a day and asked ourselves what kind of infringement liability that individual would ring up. And, you know, I made a few assumptions in my analysis. You know, I used a plausible but uncharitable reading of fair use and relevant case law and fair use. I assumed that maximum damages were going to be available. And I assumed that rights holder were going to aggressively litigate whatever potential claim they might have and take an aggressive view of copyright law. And so I developed a purely fictional character named Professor John and went through his day-to-day activities that, you know, included nothing involving what we consider to be, you know, copyright infringement of the grandest order, sort of, you know, P2P file sharing or illegal file sharing on the internet. He did none of that. He just engaged in normal activities and came up to the conclusion of that he would face liability in the fantastical amount of over $12 million a day, which would ring up over $4.5 billion in liability a year. And so, you know, the question then became, again, it was a sort of a partly tongue-in-cheek experiment, but the question became, how did we get to this point? How did we get to the point where activities that are potentially ordinary daily activities that individuals engage in and seemingly are innocuous can potentially lead to copyright liability on such a grand scale? And to me, there seemed to be a large gap between our norms, indeed the way we practice our daily lives, especially in the digital era, where we have constant access to copyrighted content and the ability to manipulate it, and the law, and what the law has increasingly said, especially as copyright law has grown more and more protective of rights holders' interests in recent decades and has expanded in scope. So that was the genesis of the project. And the book was really taking that hypothetical and then looking at the impact of copyright law on the individual in the 21st century.
The interesting point right up front is that when you did these calculations, while you're using, as you said, the maximum possible damages, the number that you're coming up with is not a number that you pull out of thin air. It's based upon statutes, correct?
Yeah, correct. The Copyright Act provides either actual damages or, assuming a plaintiff qualifies, statutory damages that are the sole election of a plaintiff in a lawsuit. And statutory damages are this incredibly powerful sword that rights holders can wield against potential infringers. And the current act allows for statutory damages up to $150,000 per act of willful infringement. And those acts can multiply very, very quickly, especially in an era of internet access. One need only look at the recent file sharing lawsuits, where you've seen multi-million dollar judgments issued against you know, the file sharers who refused to settle with the recording industry and went all the way to trial and found large assessments against them for file sharing, you know, a few dozen files.
Now, this is an area, and I think, you know, we should discuss up front. You know, as I mentioned in the introduction, you know, copyright and problems with copyright law at this point in 2011 is fairly well worn. There are a number of books that have been written on the topic, and certainly quite a bit of activism. But your book, I think, approaches this topic from a different perspective, and perhaps for a different audience than a lot or most of the writing on the topic. What do you see as your book's contribution to our discussion of the parameters of copyright, and who is the intended audience for the book?
Yeah, you know, there are some excellent books out there, and certainly a lot of individuals who are outstanding copyright specialists have discussed some of the issues that we're touching on today. So I didn't just want to rehash that in my book. Obviously, I wanted to make some kind of different contribution, also reach out to a different audience. And so my focus was largely on the impact of copyright law on the individual. And so that's what the real focus of the book is. It's speaking to the individual, and it's looking at how in the modern world, how in the digital world, as individuals, we constantly interact with copyrighted content. Copyright, in fact, affects the types of books we read, the kinds of songs we can sing, the kinds of homes we can build. It regulates almost every aspect of our daily life in ways that I think a lot of people aren't aware of or don't think about explicitly. And so the book is really, in a sense, speaking to the individual, making the case of about how relevant copyright law is to our basic daily lives, and involving the individual in the issue of copyright and the debate of copyright, especially with respect to copyright reform. And that's that, you know, I think the individual's voice is one that hasn't been heard as much as it should be. You know, copyright law for many years has been, you know, the subject of debate for academics, but also for certain industries that have strong interest in copyright. Yet the individual's interests have often been ignored in this equation, even though they are of deep importance.
The structure of the book is one that we're going to talk about in a moment. But before, which you mentioned, but before we get there, you know, I did somewhat short shrift to your background. Aside from being a professor of law, you're also an active practicing lawyer through your firm. Are there experiences that you've had in practice that that encouraged you or gave you ultimately the inspiration to write a book with this focus?
Yeah, certainly. In fact, one of the chapters is very, very much a function of my practice. It's an idea I frankly wouldn't have stumbled upon but for my practice experience. And that's the experience of, over the years, I've repeatedly been approached by individuals who have had their works, you know, undoubtedly infringed, and in ways that were harmful to them. Whether it was someone who found, you know, their landscape paintings featured very prominently in a well-known national catalog, or an individual who found aspects of their screenplay end up in a Hollywood blockbuster. And in repeated cases, I was sort of saddened with the fact that the law, although, and this is kind of the flip side of the book, you know, the book isn't all, you know, focusing on copyright as bad. Far from it. It's looking really at a more nuanced view of copyright, and again, from the individual perspective. And so one chapter actually makes the argument that although we pride ourselves as a country on supposedly having one of the most strong copyright regimes in the world, in fact, that is largely a myth. And that is because for a large segment of content creators, namely unsophisticated individuals who don't have attorneys, you know, making sure to protect their interests to the maximum extent under the law, we actually protect copyright holders far worse than any other country in the world. And reason for that is because of one singular aspect of the Copyright Act, which is the registration requirement. And just to briefly state it, under the Copyright Act, at least under the 1976 Copyright Act, in order to qualify for the provision of statutory damages, a plaintiff has to timely register their work before the infringement occurs. And the problem with this requirement is that although the sophisticated players in the content industries, you know, the big movie studios, the recording industry, all of them, they of course make sure to register their works upon publication. How for the vast majority of individuals, however, they're either not aware of the registration requirement. There are certainly some types of creators like photographers where registering your works can become cost prohibitive, and so they aren't able to register their works. Or in fact, as I give an example in the book, many screenwriters, for example, are misled into thinking that mechanisms like the Writers Guild's registration system serve as a substitute for copyright registration with the U.S. government, and so they don't properly register their works with the U.S. government. The result is when someone infringes their works, these individuals have, although they have a great claim – they have no ability to pursue the infringers because, in effect, they can't get statutory damages. And absent statutory damages, it's very hard to prove actual damages in a copyright case. And what's interesting is the United States is unique in the world, is the only country that effectively has this kind of registration requirement that really affects substantive rights. And I make the argument in a sense that this is not only a significant problem, because what it does is it allows, in fact, sophisticated content creators to enforce their violations of their copyrights to you know, crazy levels. You know, witness the recent file sharing lawsuits. But if these sophisticated content creators use someone else's content, so for example, if a major motion picture studio uses someone else's screenplay, that individual who wrote the screenplay oftentimes has no remedies against the studio for infringing their works, because the studio can simply thumb their nose and say, well, did you register your work? And the answer often is no. And if the answer is no, all of a sudden, there's no real ability to get a lawyer to go after the studio. And so that was very much born from my practice experience, where unfortunately, repeatedly, I would have to tell these potential clients with great cases of infringement that effectively, because the way the law is written, they have no remedies against what was usually a case of infringement by a large corporation.
The issues regarding the cost of litigation and indeed the statutory problems are ones that you get to in your reforms, which I want to pick up in a little while. With regard to these issues, you use the phrase copyright 2.0 or 2.0 in the subtitle of your book. What does that mean? What is copyright 2.0?
For me, copyright 2.0, obviously, it's sort of an analogy to the notion of, you know, web 2.0. But really what it is looking at copyright law in a way that makes sense for the digital era. Really, copyright 1.0 was really at the very dawn of the digital age. I mean, as I mentioned, the extant Copyright Act, the 1976 Act, didn't go into effect until January 1st, 1978, but there's been no wholesale revision of copyright since then. And the world in 1978 is dramatically different than the world of 2011. I mean, today, as I argue, we all have basically the equivalent of a printing press in our home. And it's not only in our homes. We have them in our offices. We have the equivalent of a printing press in our pocket when we have our smartphones. And, you know, these printing presses are computers, effectively. And what they allow is they allow us to manipulate copyrighted content from the four corners of the earth in a way that was certainly not possible in 1978 and even hard to imagine. And the result of that is that the law was written for a pre-digital environment, or a sort of the dawn of the digital era environment. But the realities of life, you know, that's one of those realities is the hypothetical I spin out, have made it such that we come into contact with copyrighted materials on a much far greater basis. Our machinery that we have, the printing presses we have, allow us to manipulate that content in ways that we never could before, almost sometimes automatically or without knowing. And the law, meanwhile, has gotten more and more strict in its interpretations of what constitutes an infringement of a rights holder's exclusive property protections under the Copyright Act. All of that has led to a multiplication in potential infringing activity. So, you know, for example, the hypothetical that I start the book out with, of Professor John, you know, he's engaging in a series of daily activities that are seemingly innocuous, many of which are made possible by the internet, but which technically violate copyright. So one example I give is, you know, he does the normal thing that many of us do. We reply to email, but in the process of replying and forwarding, he makes copies of other people's emails. And although this seems like an innocuous activity, technically it's an act of infringement. And that could in a case of an aggressive rights holder create a problem. Or another example is someone gives you a photograph that they took of you, and then you place it on Facebook. You know, there was no Facebook until a few years ago, but your act now of reproducing the work that someone gave you effectively could amount to an infringement of one of the exclusive rights, the right holder, the person who took the photograph, which may have been the person who gave the photograph to you, or it may have been someone else, creates a potential violation there. And, you know, as one of the basic rules of copyright goes, just because you own the physical copy, that doesn't give you any right to the copyright to the actual work. And therefore, although you own the physical copy, you don't necessarily have a right to reproduce it, distribute it, publicly display it, or do anything else. So those are examples of the kinds of infringements that have become enabled in the digital era. And really, the idea of copyright 2.0 is a copyright that accounts for the vast change in the world that's occurred in the last 3.5 decades.
We're chatting with Professor John Turanian of Chapman University School of Law, author of the book Infringement Nation, Copyright 2.0 and You on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. John, as you survey the landscape today, you've written a book aimed at the individual, implying, I think, that individuals, I think you've said in so many words, are not familiar or may not be familiar with all of the different ways that copyright intrudes into day-to-day activities. You know, in your experience in practice, have you found over the last, let's say, 6 or 7 years as copyright scholarship and copyright litigation has become more prominent, that individuals are more sophisticated in their understanding of copyright, or is there still generally the presumption that either this isn't a copyright issue, or even if it is, it's not one that is going to rise to a level where anyone needs to be concerned?
You know, I think that copyright consciousness, as I would call it, has increased by leaps and bounds in the last decade. It's actually truly remarkable, but there's still a lot of room there. There's still fundamental misunderstandings about the nature of copyright. For example, most ordinary individuals don't understand that a work under U.S. law is protected as copyrighted the second that you fixate it in a tangible medium. So as long as it's an original work of authorship, you have a copyright from the moment of fixation. There are all kinds of urban myths about getting a copyright still by mailing, you know, an envelope that's closed through the U.S. mail to yourself, or any other kinds of mechanisms. And there's still a lot of misunderstandings. But I think what's happened in the last decade or so is copyright issues have risen to the forefront. And you've touched on, you know, a couple of reasons for that. I think the incredible rise of intellectual property litigation or copyright litigation, in particular the campaigns against Napster, Grokster, and then the targeting of individual users by the recording industry, has raised copyright awareness greatly. Parents have had to become aware of what their kids are doing on the computer because it could mean liability for them. Individuals have begun to ask questions as to why are the damages so high? Is this something that is fair and or reasonable? The way I see it is although, you know, copyright, you know, for many decades was relegated to the, to the hinterlands of, you know, the judiciary even, and with sort of the obscure interest of a few academics and maybe people in the content creation industries, the last decade or so has seen a large widespread emergence of copyright consciousness. You've begun to see articles in sort of, you know, sophisticated magazines that are for a widespread or more general audience, like the New Yorker or the Atlantic Monthly or Harper's, that actually address issues of copyright. There are people who have grown increasingly concerned with the scope of copyright. In 1998, for example, Congress, of course, famously passed a 20-year extension, the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, to the to existing copyrights and all new copyrights. And that bill, basically passed through Congress with very little debate, not even an actual roll call vote, but rather just a voice vote. But in the years since then, a lot of people have become concerned about what that legislation did, how it took works that were about to fall into public domain and increase their copyright term by 20 years, and began to focus on what that means for the public. And so, you know, for example, in my book, I give an example. A couple years later, there was a bill through Congress that attempted to make what were called procedural, very technical amendments to the Copyright Act, but really they were rather significant in that they affected the potential rights of musicians to do something called terminate, which is to get back copyrights they had signed over potentially to the recording to the record labels. And the bill passed through Congress sort of without much debate, but the second people found out about it, there was a wave of activism on behalf of artists' rights groups that felt that the recording industry had sort of fooled Congress and passed this legislation in the middle of the night. And Congress took the remarkable step of actually repealing the legislation and leaving the question over the status of the Works Made for Hire doctrine's application to sound recordings, which was the issue, to courts of the future. But that, I think, was a small wave of activism that is going to be increasingly prevalent. We see it in the creation of groups like Public Knowledge or Larry Lessig's The Creative Commons, which have really begun to look and focus on the issue of copyright as something that is an issue for the public and certainly a very strong component of the public interest. And so I see that there's been really a large change in the last 10 years, and I think that's going to only increase.
Do you have a – before we take a break, John, since you raised it, I was going to ask about this later, but I'll ask now. Do you have a view on the – and this is news from the past week – on the granting of certiorari by the U.S. Supreme Court in Golan v. Holder, which, had been litigated through CIS, through Stanford Center of Internet and Society. I should say that as a disclaimer, but is a case that deals directly with restoring works to copyright protection from the public domain. Do you have any opinion on that appeal? And perhaps I'm not going to ask the crystal ball question, but any thoughts you have on the outcome?
Yeah, you know, I'll hesitate on the crystal ball, but I think it's a tremendously important case, and it's a case where really the Supreme Court, which just took cert, is going to have to squarely address the issue of copyright and the public domain, and really deal with issues of potentially constitutionality and the First Amendment. You know, the case, of course, centers around the constitutionality of provisions of the Copyright Act, Section 104A, and that were passed pursuant to the Uruguay round of GATT, that basically allowed for certain works that had fallen into the public domain in the United States because those works were foreign and had not adhered to certain formalities that existed prior to the passage of the 76 Copyright Act and the Berne Convention in the United States. Those works had fallen to the public domain. Section 104A effectively took those works and recopyrighted them. And so there's a question as to whether one can ever take things from the public domain and repropertize them, and whether that potentially violates the Constitution, be it the First Amendment or even the Copyright Clause of the Constitution. And, you know, I'm strongly supported Stanford's position in the litigation in terms of for their client, and you know, I do feel fundamentally that it is violative of both First Amendment rights and inconsistent with the Copyright Clause of the Constitution, which focuses on copyright as an incentive for authors to create. And again, it seems hard pressed to me to explain how a retroactive changing of the status of existing copyrighted works for authors who are long dead does anything to encourage progress in the arts as mandated by the U.S. Constitution and the Copyright Clause, which is in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8.
We're chatting with Professor John Turanian of Chapman University School of Law, author of the book Infringement Nation, Copyright 2.0 and You on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU, and the webpage is at kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to the station and to Hearsay Culture. John, returning to Golan for a moment, but the larger issue of restoring copyright protection, where do you situate a case like Golan, which, as you mentioned, comes out of an international agreement that required the United States to alter these laws in order to conform to the agreements themselves, in the wider spectrum of where copyright is today? I mean, because again, as you mentioned, I mean, this goes back at this point over 20 years in terms of the inception of this issue ultimately arising. Is Golan, I hate to use these kinds of cliches, but is it a symptom of a larger issue? Is it the problem itself? And then how would you situate Golan in terms of the role or the problems that individuals run into in copyright and dealing with copyright law?
Well, I think Golan creates, you know, highlights an issue, which is it's very hard, in fact, to figure out what a lot of the status of a lot of materials that are older and whether they are copyrighted or not. And in one sense, Golan just adds to that problem. The restoration of works that were formerly copyrighted and then were not copyrighted and now are copyrighted again is a real potential problem, because it adds a layer of additional complexity to a question that anybody who is trying to use pre-existing materials is we're very readily familiar with. If you try to use any work from approximately 1923 until the mid 60s, its copyright status is very much in question. It rides on the series of formalities that were in place at the time, whether those formalities were obeyed. It relies on whether proper renewal of a copyright was made back in the old days when a copyright renewal is required in the 28th year of a copyright term. And there were all sorts of complexities as to who owned renewal rights. And, you know, the restoration of works that had fallen to the public domain only adds another layer of complexity. You know, one example I give is the famous photograph of Che Guevara that has become used in many commercials and in advertising. And the state, I believe, of Corda, Albert Corda, who's the photographer, has begun to reassert its rights in recent years, in part based on the restoration of the copyright to that photograph. And in my book, I sort of analyze whether the photograph is in fact copyrighted still. And the analysis is somewhat complex, but it highlights the issue that restoration creates with respect to the use of works. But another broader point here that I think bears mentioning is also that this issue arose from international negotiations and potential international treaty obligations. And that's sort of another widespread trend in copyright, is the idea that there's increasing harmonization of copyright law. Now, harmonization can be a good thing. It can certainly create a greater uniform standard for copyright protection, which can benefit everyone. It creates a greater legibility in terms of what the law is internationally, and especially can be useful to fuel an international marketplace by creating certain base guidelines for how that marketplace will result. Because as of now, right, every nation has its own copyright laws, and some nations don't even have copyright laws. But one of the problems with harmonization is that effectively it takes out local differences, and differences that may be terribly warranted. And the harmonization system doesn't necessarily account for that, and that's potentially a real problem. An example I like to give is, of course, rhetorically, we as a country talk about how, you know, we want strong copyright protection. As I mentioned earlier, I'm not sure that's entirely true, since we don't protect unsophisticated creators at all in our country, as opposed to other countries. But let's assume our rhetoric is true and we want strong copyright protection. Of course, based on that, the U.S. has made it a strong foreign policy goal to enter into treaties that have other countries provide stronger copyright protection and enforcement investment. It's no secret that that piracy issues in China and India and other major developing countries are a deep concern to U.S. interests, since one of our strongest, most profitable industries is our copyrightable content, whether it's software or recordings or Hollywood. But one of the flip sides of that, of course, is it ignores a history that the United States has of being sort of the leading pirate nation in the world. It wasn't really until the late 1800s the U.S. recognized the copyright of any foreign author. And in fact, Charles Dickens famously kept on coming to the United States to lobby Congress to give him protection for his works, because his works were being infringed and the U.S. government would do nothing about it because they said his works weren't protected in the United States. And the argument the U.S. made at the time was, we're a developing country. We can't afford to pay royalties to the author for the works, and the works are important for education and development purposes. Interestingly enough, those are exactly the same arguments that individuals in China might make or India might make, for the reasons that their countries shouldn't have to have the exact same copyright laws as the United States. And so that's, I think, a big issue that's taking center stage.
With regard to fair use, which is something that we've started to allude to here, and I want to spend some time on, before we get to ultimately, I want to get your opinions on the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement and the more recent secret copyright-related agreements that are being negotiated on the international stage. But you spent a good amount of time in the book analyzing the fair use defense to copyright infringement, and pointing out that it has significant shortcomings from the standpoint of its existence, as opposed to tinkering with the formula itself. You criticize fair use as a doctrine because, in your view, I want you to expand on it, it undermines our understanding of what copyright should be. And this is an unusual critique of the defense. So perhaps you can expand on that. What's the problem with fair use?
Sure. I mean, the argument is counterintuitive, but fair use is often hailed as this sort of vindication of First Amendment interests or the public domain or public rights of access to copyrighted works. The fair use defense, of course, is a defense that says that even though you may be technically infringing under the law, you face no liability because a use is deemed to be fair use. And the way fair use works is it's an affirmative defense. It's something that has to be pled, and then the burden of proof is on a defendant to make a claim of fair use. And courts use a four-part balancing test to figure out whether something is in fact a fair use. What they typically look at is they look to see what the nature of the use is. They look at the nature of the copyrighted work you're using, the amount and substantiality of the use of that work, and the potential market harm you're doing to that work, whether it is to the market for that work or potential derivative markets for that work. And the fair use test was codified in the Copyright Act of 1976, but its origins are much earlier. They date back to a case from the 1840s, Folsom v. Marsh, by Justice Story, where he announced a sort of a new doctrine, the fair use doctrine, and gave effectively the four-part balancing test that we know today. The test was widely adopted then by other courts hearing copyright cases, and really it became a central part of copyright jurisprudence, although it wasn't technically codified in the Copyright Act until 1976. So you might ask, well, what's wrong with fair use? After all, it gives people an out from infringement if they're making certain types of uses of work. So, for example, famously, parodies are given very strong protection under the fair use doctrine. My argument basically looks at the origins of the fair use doctrine and compares the copyright regime before fair use and after fair use. And what one sees is actually that fair use played an instrumental role in fundamentally transforming our notion of copyright and copyright infringement. Basically, as I argue, copyright law in its early years was very much utilitarian in its bent. The concern, I believe, is reflected in the Constitution, where the Constitution's clause that empowers Congress to give copyright protection states the purpose for that protection. It states that the protection is for progress in the arts. And I think that's significant because if you think about it, the Constitution usually doesn't state the reason for a power. We're told that the Congress may make no law abridging the freedom of speech, but we're not told why by the Constitution. In fact, the only part of the Constitution that seems to to give any indication as for the reason for a power or a limitation is the Second Amendment and the Copyright Clause. And so it was very utilitarian bent. The point was copyright protection was extended to authors in order to achieve progress in the arts. It wasn't because authors, for example, may have an inherent property right in anything with which they mix their labor. That would be a more sort of natural law view of copyright, where the idea is sort of based on the principles of John Locke and this idea of sweat of the brow and the idea that you should have an inherent property right in anything that you with which you mix your labor. Now, in the early years of copyright, therefore, when someone was accused of infringement, they could per se say that the act that they were that they had engaged in was not infringing by simply saying that what they had done was transformative. So copyright effectively protected literal reproduction of a work one-to-one. And I think the quintessential example of this, and you could always say you weren't infringing by saying, look, I did something transformative. I didn't literally copy the work. I did something new and useful, something that was accretive to progress in the arts. So the case I focus on in the book is a very interesting case involving one of the most famous pieces of American literature, which is Uncle Tom's Cabin. Harriet Beecher Stowe, of course, famously wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. Less famously, though, her husband translated Uncle Tom's Cabin into German, in large part because there was a large German-speaking population in the United States at the time, especially in Pennsylvania. Now, Mr. Stowe's work did not sell that well in these areas. Apparently, the translation was somewhat lacking. And so some enterprising individual decided to have at it and make their own translation of Uncle Tom's Cabin. And they went ahead and translated it, put it out in the market, and it started selling like crazy. And did very well. Harriet Beecher Stowe was not happy and filed suit, claiming that the translation, the unauthorized translation of Uncle Tom's Cabin into German, was in fact an act of infringement. And what's remarkable is the case ended up finding no infringement. And what's particularly remarkable is the logic of the court. The court basically said, "Well, look, the new version of Uncle Tom's Cabin, although unauthorized in German, is selling much better than the authorized German translation. Instead of saying that's infringing, we should be congratulating the alleged infringers for putting together a work that is much more readable. And moreover, a work of translation is a difficult thing to accomplish. It's accretive to progress in the arts. Making a good translation is oftentimes as good as writing an original work. And therefore, the court found no infringement." That was in the days before the fair use test. What happened with fair use is fair use all of a sudden said, what we're going to look at is, was there a taking of the original work? And then if you want to excuse liability, we'll focus on fair use. But the burden is going to be on the defendant. It's an affirmative defense that the defendant has to prove. And on top of that, fair use, if you think about the factors that are drawn upon, they are largely natural law in origin. What is focusing in the fair use, three out of the four parts of the fair use test focus on what you're taking from the author, not what use you're making. So while the world before fair use really focused on if you're taking a work and using it for a transformative purpose, it's per se non-infringing. Fair use said, well, if you've taken a work, it's per se infringing. Then we look at fair use. And three of those four factors focus on what are you taking from the author? In other words, what is the nature of the copyrighted work? How much of the copyrighted work are you using? What's the harm to the copyrighted work? If you think about the Harriet Beecher Stowe case, under the fair use doctrine, it's unequivocally not fair use because the factors simply weigh against fair use because you're taking something from the author. The focus isn't on what use are you creating. And so my argument is basically that fair use allowed the reintroduction of repudiated natural law elements or factors into the copyright calculus and fundamentally changed the course of copyright law in a way that gave greater credence to inherent notions of property rights that authors should have in their creations versus a focus that was previously made on what use is being made of the copyrighted work and does this add to progress in the arts.
The fair use defense being heavily litigated is one that has been explored heavily. Have you seen this argument coming up, particularly in cases where you've sensed a level of sympathy for the argument that fair use should go back to, and I'll use this phrase, its core primary purpose to protect transformative works?
Yeah, I mean, one example where I think the courts have really, in a sense, failed to vindicate the original purpose of the copyright regime, which is to encourage, progress in the arts and to that end, encourage transformative uses, is the way the courts have read the famous Supreme Court ruling of Campbell v. Acuff Rose. Of course, that case was famously a pro-fair use argument, where Two Live Crew was, of course, accused of infringing Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman with their take of Pretty Woman, and the court in fact found that the use was permitted as parody, and the court basically said that transformative uses deserve strong protection under fair use. Unfortunately, though, courts have read this this case very in a very limited way. So although parody has tended to get great protection from courts, it's sort of ugly stepchild satire has not. And sort of courts distinguish between parody and satire by saying parody is when you take a work and you mock the work itself. Satire, on the other hand, is when you take a work and make a broader point about society or about some other work or some other issue. Courts have said that for parody, you necessarily need to conjure up enough of the original so people know what you're talking about, and it's by necessity that there's going to be a fair use defense available for parody. But courts have said you don't have the same necessity for satire. For example, there was a case involving a O.J. Simpson trial or mockery that used Dr. Seuss, Cat in the Hat. And the court found infringement there, not fair use, because they said that the work was not a parody. It wasn't making fun of the Cat in the Hat. It was using it as a satire, the O.J. Simpson trial, and more broad societal issues, and therefore was not mocking the work itself. It was a satire, not a parody. Therefore, there wasn't the same necessity for using the Cat in the Hat. In other words, the court said, if you want to mock the O.J. Simpson trial or society, use a work that you have rights to. But the thing is that, fair use or even our original notion of copyright has never been about necessity. Do you have to use this underlying work to make your point? It's more been about what are you doing with the work? Are you engaging in a transformative use? And I think satires are just as transformative as parody. They certainly can be accretive to progress in the arts. They can certainly raise new ideas, vindicate certain First Amendment interests, and can be an important part of public discourse. And they, unfortunately, largely have not received protection through the fair use doctrine.
We're chatting with Professor John Turanian of Chapman University School of Law, author of the book Infringement Nation on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. John, we have about 6 minutes left where I get to some unfair questions. We've discussed implicitly one of the reforms that you suggest in your book to copyright, that is this return to a focus on transformation. What other primary reforms do you suggest for correcting the problems that you've identified with copyright law?
Sure. The final chapter of the book looks at the individual's reform, and it's sort of a call to individuals to think about how copyright law might be reformed to make more sense for individuals operating their lives in the 21st century. And sort of I give my reforms in sort of three different categories. The first is are reforms that I think would not be easy to implement, but are certainly plausible. The second are reforms that might be somewhat more challenging. And the third is sort of a radical reform that I propose that would alienate many embedded interests and therefore it realistically has no chance of passing anytime soon, but I think is worthy of debate. So in terms of sort of the goals of the reforms, the goals are to restore balance between users and rights holders of copyrighted content. The argument I make throughout the book is that balance has been disrupted in large part because of fundamental changes in copyright doctrine. And I also look to temper the disparity between sophisticated and unsophisticated parties, and also recalibrate the relationship between transformative users and original creators of copyrighted content. So specific proposals I make are things from as nitpicky as the way attorney's fees are apportioned or awarded in copyright litigation, to potentially creating a cause of action for overexertion of rights. There's a big problem that's been dubbed by some scholars as a problem of copy fraud, where institutions and companies claim copyright in works that either belong in the public domain or they claim copyright says one thing when it really says another, and this creates a large chilling of expressive rights and vindication of public rights to access to works. And so I talk about that. In terms of the radical proposal really looks at transforming the copyright regime in some ways from a property regime to a liability regime for certain categories of works. And specifically, I argue that transformative uses lie at the heart and soul of the utilitarian concerns that illuminated the framers' protection of copyright, namely the idea that we want to help encourage progress in the arts. And to that end, my argument is that the potential property rights that copyright gives to copyright owners, namely the right to say absolutely no, you cannot use my work under any circumstances, that position can be very negative for progress in the arts. And although people can rely on a fair use defense, I argue, look, fair use is notoriously fickle. It's something you cannot find out about until after you've litigated a case, in which case you're looking at substantial risk of liability, and you're going to have to pay an attorney quite a bit of money to even get to the point of litigating a fair use claim. And it basically doesn't serve its purpose. So my argument is that for certain categories of transformative uses, we say that as a de facto rule, what's going to happen is that a copyright holder cannot say no, that individuals can make those transformative uses of a copyrighted work. But if they do, what they're liable for is for an accounting of profits from that use. And as a default rule, I argue that the profits should be split 50-50 between the original creator and the transformative user. Of course, parties would then be free to engage in whatever licensing arrangements or whatever alternative deal they might want to make to the 50-50 regime. But I think what that effectively does is it allows individuals to make transformative use of copyrighted works for non-commercial purposes for free. It allows original creators to continue to be compensated for the use of their works, but it prevents them from saying absolutely no, you can't use my work, and therefore stifle progress in the arts.
John, we have about 1 minute left. I hesitate to do this. I'm going to do it anyway, as the host prerogative. Quickly, in 1 minute, any views on ACTA, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, from what we know of it? What's your take on it?
Yeah, I mentioned in the book a little bit, it's from what we know of it. There is certainly very, very strong reasons to question it. Anytime a treaty is negotiated entirely in secret, even though it involves issues of deep public importance, that immediately, raises one's eyebrows. But some of the potential provisions of ACTA are very problematic. There have been talk that there would be, empowerment of border officials to do searches of laptops for pirated content. Of course, that begs the question, how are border officials going to apply copyright law when even copyright scholars who are well-versed in copyright law can't necessarily tell you with any accuracy what's going to be a fair use and what isn't? This creates real privacy issues, real First Amendment problems, and we've already begun to see the impact of the federal government effectively carrying out some of the preview of ACTA in recent efforts by ICE. to shut down certain web names or domain names that are engaging in pirated content. The real concern here is not the, you know, obviously stopping pirated content is an important interest, but at the same time, there's a question as to what are the checks and balances that are occurring prior to the seizure of this property, and who are these, you know, powers going to be used against? And what about fair use? Who's considering fair use in the public interest in enacting these types of powers?
John Turanian, professor at Chapman University School of Law, author of the book Infringement Nation, Copyright 2.0 on You. John, I appreciate you taking the time to chat on the show today. I certainly invite you back as you are a repeat guest. We can continue the trend down the road. But thank you for taking the time today on Hearsay Culture.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks so much, Dave, for having me.
I'm excited to mention a number of guests who will be coming up next quarter. This is the last show of the winter quarter for KZSU. We have a couple of weeks of interim where I don't do new shows, but then new shows will commence in April. And among the guests coming up in the next quarter will be Professor Andy Hiley of Elon University School of Law, discussing online sales taxation. Professor Jennifer Urban, the director of the Sales and Law Technology and Public Policy Clinic at UC Berkeley. Professor David Post of Temple University Beasley School of Law, author of In Search of Jefferson's Moose, Notes on the State of Cyberspace. Professor Dan Hunter of New York Law School, and Professor Dan Solove of George Washington University Law School, author of Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. Kevin Poulsen of Wired Magazine, author of Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over the Billion-Dollar Cybercrime Underground. Kevin Kelly, also of Wired Magazine, author of What Technology Wants. Adam Pennenberg of New York University, author of Viral Loop, From Facebook to Twitter, and Today's Smartest Businesses Grow Themselves. Pamela Long, author of a fascinating history of the obelisk, and co-author of the book Obelisk, A History. Ken Werbach of Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And also Professor Mario Biagli of UC Davis will be on the show as well. I'm very excited to mention these guests and also to advise you that you can get the show primarily live Tuesdays, 11 to 12 a.m. Pacific time. This show, in fact, is being recorded on March 15th and therefore is airing on the same day. But you can also get the show by podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, by going to iTunes search engine and typing in Center for Internet Society, where you can subscribe to CIS's podcasts, or lastly, by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu, Stanford CIS's webpage. I look forward to chatting with you next semester. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So have a good few weeks, and we'll talk again in April. Have a great day.